It all began in ancient Greece.
Athens, to be precise.
It was they who invented the word for it.
Demokratia, rule by the people. Not that we would have recognised, I think, Athenian society as particularly democratic by our 20th century standards.
After all, neither women nor slaves had any political rights at all in Athens.
And since together they probably constituted at least 90% of the adult population, Athens was hardly an outstanding example of majority rule, was it?
What's more, one strongly suspects that had some Chartist or suffragette protester arisen demanding universal franchise, they would have quickly followed Socrates to the bowl of hemlock. For in its own way, Greek democracy was every bit as oppressively class-conscious as the aristocracy of Louis XIV or Tsar Nicholas, come to that. It wasn't, you see, our modern theory of egalitarianism that motivated their unique political experiment. It was something far more pragmatic, namely a profound suspicion of dictators. See, the Greeks had had plenty of contact with despotic rule throughout their history. They'd observed it in the vast Persian Empire of Xerxes, and they despised it with a fierce contempt. More importantly, probably, they'd experienced it in the early centuries of their own development, as political opportunists had seized control of young city-states like Corinth and Athens and then vied with one another in exhibitionist displays of autocratic power. They called them tyrants. They were honest enough to recognise that some of them were shrewd and effective rulers. But even the best of them were disliked and distrusted by the citizens of Athens. So their popular storybooks were full of derogatory stories about the crudity and the excess of unconstitutional government. Their poets and their playwrights reinforced the thought with their own more refined and subtle propaganda. And great philosophers like Plato added the weight of their intellects to this collective determination never to allow their beloved Athens to fall into such unworthy, tyrannical hands again. And so with characteristic originality, their political system emerged. A system which, as Pericles, their great leader, was at pains to point out in one of his most famous speeches, a system which was without precedent in the ancient world. Our constitution doesn't copy the laws of neighbouring states. We are a pattern for others rather than imitators ourselves, he says. For our administration favours the many instead of the few. That's why we call it democracy. And of course, even now, 2,000 years later, Pericles' claim is still true. The Athenian system, albeit much modified, is still a model which excites the admiration and the emulation of just about every people on earth. There is scarcely a government in the world today which would not wish to dignify itself by the title democratic, no matter how spuriously applied. For we too, like those Greeks, have learned to detest dictators. And what better way of defending ourselves against them than by investing ultimate political authority in the people? The Greeks were right, we say. Surely democracy is the obvious and infallible answer to the threat of tyranny. Or is it? That's the question I want you to think about with me this morning. For it's raised for us by this fascinating chapter with which our studies in Samuel begin. 1 Samuel 8. Here, you see, is another infant nation wrestling with the vital question of what political system it ought to adopt. Not a Greek polis this time. Indeed, the events of 1 Samuel took place some 5 centuries before the golden age of Pericles. Now, this emergent state is Israel. And yet, in certain respects, her political priorities were not unlike those of Athens. She, too, had had her fill of tyrants. Long years of bondage under Pharaoh of Egypt had taught her the value of civil liberty. But how was that freedom to be protected? That was the question. And what I want you to notice this morning is this, that according to the Bible, according to 1 Samuel 8, the answer to that most fundamental question of all practical politics does not lie in democracy at all. It lies in theocracy. Not in the doctrine of the sovereignty of the people, but in the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. As usual, we'll break the passage up to help us in our study of it. We'll look first at verses 1 to 5, under the heading, "The Will of the People," as it was represented to Samuel by the demand of the elders. And then we'll look at verses 6 to 9, under the heading, "The Will of God," as it was discovered by Samuel's prayer. And then thirdly, we'll look at the consequences of the victory of the former, the will of the people, over that insight of Samuel in verses 10 to 18. First of all, then, the will of the people. Verses 4 and 5. "So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, 'You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have.'" Now, up until this point in her history, Israel had been a fairly loosely knit confederation of tribes, administered by local chieftains, much as you find in some parts of Africa today. The elders, as they're called in verse 4, the elders of Israel, the clan leaders, the chiefs. Of course, a national consciousness existed. They were all united by a common ancestor, Abraham, and by a common history in their experience of the Exodus. And supremely, of course, by a common God, their covenant with Jehovah. But there was no machinery of state to give expression to this sense of intertribal solidarity at this time. Not even a capital city. The nearest they got to a political symbol of their national unity was a group of men, and occasionally women, called the Judges. We read about them in the book that's called Judges, that comes shortly before Samuel. These individuals seem to have fulfilled two functions. On the one hand, they were military leaders who had the capacity to muster the tribes to joint action against their adversaries, particularly in times of national emergency. Some of you, I expect, remember from Sunday school the story of Gideon. Well, he was raised up to meet the challenge of a Midianite invasion. Or you remember the story of Samson. Well, of course, his story centers around the Philistine threat against Israel. So they were military leaders. But in addition, they were also often judicial figures before whom difficult legal cases, especially one suspects, intertribal wrangles, were settled. We read of Deborah, for instance, one of the female judges. She held court in the hill country of Ephrah, and the Israelites came to her to have their disputes decided. Whether they majored on the military side or on the judicial side, however, these judges all had one thing in common. They were charismatic figures. They sprang up without warning and always with some clear evidence of divine election. Sometimes, like Gideon, they had met an angel of the Lord. Sometimes, like Deborah, they had a prophetic gift. Sometimes, like Samson, they were endowed with supernatural physical powers. But one way or another, they were always people upon whom the Spirit of God had come in some very obvious and perhaps dramatic way. It was to this noble order that Samuel belonged. Indeed, he was probably the greatest of all the judges. From childhood, he had been recognized by all the tribes as a prophet, a man of the Spirit. And in chapter 7, the chapter before the one we read, we find him exercising both the military and the judicial functions of a judge. We see him, for instance, in chapter 7, verse 7, exercising a power of deliverance of the people from Philistine oppression by his prayers. And then at the end of chapter 7, in verse 15, we find him engaged as a kind of circuit judge, regularly touring the shrines of Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah from his home base at Ramah and presiding over a kind of quarter sessions at each stop. Now, this had been the pattern of political life in Israel ever since the death of Joshua, 200 years or so before. And as far as Samuel was concerned, it had all worked pretty well. But clearly that wasn't the opinion of the general public any longer, was it? Political discontent was fomenting. You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us. Now this really was pretty revolutionary stuff. We don't want to be a tribal confederation anymore, they were saying. We want to be a centralized monarchy. It was a demand for constitutional change, every bit as radical as Cromwell's Commonwealth or Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. We want a king. But why did they want a king? It's important for our assessment of the rights and wrongs of the situation to establish that. I think if we look at the chapter, we can identify three contributory reasons for this monarchist aspiration of the people. The first was a desire for secure leadership succession. Did you catch the hint in verse 5? You're old, Samuel. You know what happens to old people, Samuel? They die. Then where will we be? Your sons do not walk in your ways. See, the trouble with the judges was that they were just plain unpredictable. The people had no control over their availability. Indeed, the book of Judges tells us one of the ways God showed his disapproval of Israel's idolatry was by withholding such leadership gifts and so forcing Israel to suffer enemy conquest or internal strife. Well, the people, it seems, had had enough of this kind of uncertainty. They didn't want Samuel to die and leave a leadership vacuum behind him. They wanted to be sure who would hold the reins in future. Indeed, it may be that it was Samuel's anticipation of this mood among the people that had led him to appoint his sons as judges at Beersheba. Perhaps he was trying to diffuse this demand for constitutional change before it reached explosion point. If that's so, he really should have known better, shouldn't he? Because, of course, the whole point about judges is that they were not hereditary rulers. Back in Judges chapter 8, Gideon had rejected the title king when the people offered it to him for precisely this reason, because of its dynastic implications. I will not reign over you, he says, nor will my son, nor will my grandson. What's more, Samuel ought to have known from experience the futility of relying upon the fact that sons will always follow in their father's footsteps. They don't. He himself had succeeded Eli precisely because Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, had lacked the spiritual and moral qualities of their father. And he surely could not have been blind to the fact that in his own sons, Joel and Abijah, history was repeating itself in this regard. In fact, when you think about it, there's a kind of curious irony about the whole situation here in verses 1 to 4. Because the people are complaining to Samuel of the transparent inadequacy of his attempts to set up a dynasty, and yet in the same breath, they are demanding the establishment of a dynastic system 10 times more permanent and inflexible than Samuel's could ever be as an answer to the problem. Such is the fickleness of people. Give us a king, they say. But how are we to know that king's sons are going to be more competent to rule than judges' sons? Nevertheless, a desire for leadership succession seems to have been behind their aspirations for a king. A second thing we can identify there as a motive behind this demand for a king is the problem of a pressing military crisis. Look at verse 20. We will be like all the other nations with a king to lead us to go out before us and fight our battles. And if you turn over to chapter 12, verse 12, you'll find that there was one particular battle that was brewing at that particular time, which they had particularly on their minds. The Ammonites were besieging Jabesh-Gilead. See, in the 2 centuries that had passed since their occupation of Canaan, the technology of war had changed quite a lot in the Middle East. Israel wasn't facing just rabbles of poorly organized peasants any longer. There were the Philistines. Now the Philistines had armies of disciplined soldiers equipped with the weaponry of the Iron Age. And then there were these Ammonites, a cruelly sadistic neighbor with territorial ambitions on Transjordan. The old tribal master they'd always relied upon was no longer adequate. The opposition was too great and their military sophistication too advanced. Oh, they said, we must have a standing army to cope with this kind of threat. We must have military specialists. We must have a king to fight our battles. Fear of conquest was undoubtedly another factor in their demand for a king. But the third, and judging from its repetition in this chapter 8, the principal reason in the mind of the inspired narrator here for their desire for a king was something else again. It was nationalistic pride. Look at verse 5. A king such as all the other nations have. Verse 20. Then we shall be like all the other nations and have a king to march in front of us, to lead us. In other words, you see, what was really bugging these Israelites, quite apart from the uncertainties of Samuel's successor and the immediate problem of defense, what was really bugging them was the humiliating sense of being somehow behind the times and out of fashion on the international scene. The Philistines have a king to lead them. The Ammonites have a king to lead them. All the surrounding Canaanite nations are monarchies. And why are we still running around like a bunch of uncivilized primitives then? No wonder we're not making any progress. We are playing Red Indians and all the rest of the world has put on the uniform of the US Cavalry. We need more centralization, more organization, more efficiency. In short, we need a king. He'll pull us all together. He'll give us some collective pride in the face of our enemies. He'll build up our national morale. A king is a national status symbol these days, Samuel. And in international politics, as in every other walk of life, you've got to keep up with the Joneses. Give us a king, like all the other nations. Well, this then was the will of the people, a populist demand, not as we've become rather accustomed to in recent centuries, in order to displace a monarchy, but to establish one. Now, what does a good democrat think about that? Theoretically, of course, the will of the people has to be obeyed. It's always right. But that clearly wasn't a sentiment that commended itself particularly to Samuel. As far as he was concerned, it was by no means self-evident that the will of the people had to be done in this respect. In his mind, there was a political determinant of far greater weight than a mere show of hands. And that brings us to our second major heading in this chapter, the will of God. Look at verse 6. When they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. Now we have a problem. It's a problem which has perplexed scholars whenever they've come to this chapter. Why exactly was Samuel so unhappy about the idea of a king? For according to a more general reading of the Old Testament, he shouldn't really have been so. Well, think about it. For a start, Moses had made provision for a king in the law. You can read about it in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Indeed, it may very well be that the people, in coming to Samuel in this way, are actually claiming a constitutional right, echoing the words of Deuteronomy 17 when they say, "Give us a king like the other nations." Their demand was a perfectly legal one. Secondly, all the way through the book of Judges, the inspired narrator keeps inserting little comments to the effects that a great deal of the internal troubles in Israel were the consequence of there being no king in the land. He keeps on saying it. In those days, anarchy prevailed because there was no king, he says. So monarchy is not just a legal thing. It was a great expedient in the days of Samuel, according to the writer of the book of Judges, who may very well have been the same writer as the book of Samuel. Thirdly, when you look later on in the books of Samuel, you find that the main bulk of the narrative is wholly favorable to the idea of the monarchy. David quickly emerges as a great national hero, a man after God's own heart. So monarchy, according to a general reading of the Bible, is not just legal, it's not just expedient. It became a very successful institution, at least in the short term. So all this being so, how are we to explain this initial negative reaction on Samuel's part? Well, one solution, of course, is that posed by the critical scholars. They suggest that there are, in fact, two different source documents that have been wedded together to make the Book of Samuel. One is a collection of pro-monarchy stories, deriving from round about the time of David. The other, they say, is a piece of anti-monarchy propaganda from much later on, deriving from the time when everyone was disillusioned with the monarchy after Solomon. And some editor, they say, has simply conflated these two parallel accounts, a fact which explains the duplication and the inconsistency in the narrative on this question of monarchy. Well, now, undoubtedly, the author of 1 Samuel has incorporated into his work stories and possibly documentary material to which he had access. Even an untrained eye can detect some evidence of that. But it's surely rather naive, isn't it, to suggest that he would try to blend two totally contradictory viewpoints on so fundamental an issue as whether Israel should have a king or not. Surely he had some opinion on it himself. What possible purpose could he have for compiling so ambiguous and confusing a work? Now, I suggest these critics are greatly underestimating the creative literary gift and the intellectual integrity of the mind that shaped this grand account of the rise of David. And certainly, for those of us who believe that the Holy Spirit is the ultimate author of this book, how are we to identify the Word of God if what we are presented with here is a hodgepodge of political prejudice and historical misrepresentation? No, that won't do. Not for me, anyway. A second alternative is to accept the historical accuracy of the characterization of Samuel, which we have here in chapter 8, but to take the line that he is wholly mistaken in his opinion on the monarchy. And that's quite a tempting attitude. After all, humanly speaking, it would be easy to put Samuel's line here all down to injured pride. It's never nice to be told you're getting too old for a job, nor to have the shortcomings of your children pointed out to you by other people. Perhaps there's even the suspicion of sour grapes here in verse 7. Do you notice? It is not you they have rejected as king. Was Samuel of the opinion that if anyone should be king, he should be? Perhaps our translation is right in just hinting that that might be in the mind of the narrator. Now, it's not difficult to find very natural explanations of Samuel's rather dog-in-the-manger attitude towards the leadership of the nation, even if there were no sense of personal pique involved. Senility tends to make people conservative, doesn't it? And reluctant to change. If Samuel had been an ordinary old man, one would have no difficulty in writing off his negative opinions as just geriatric stubbornness. But unfortunately, however, though such a psychological analysis is very tempting and probably contains elements of truth, for Samuel was a real human being and not an angel after all. Nevertheless, this text won't allow us to dismiss his point of view in quite so patronizing a manner. For you see, Samuel was a prophet. And according to our narrator, the Lord confirmed Samuel's hesitation on this matter of the monarchy by a revelation of his divine word. Do you see that in verse 7? The Lord told him, "Listen to all the people are saying to you. It's not you they have rejected as their king, but me, as they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you." There's something rather touching about that, actually. This message of consolation God gives to his elderly prophet. "I know you're feeling hurt," he says, "by their enthusiasm to put you out to grass. But don't get upset about it. They're only doing to you what they've done to me countless times. I understand how you're feeling, Samuel. I felt like it myself. In fact, right now, we both feel the same." Can there be any greater consolation, any greater comfort for us in those moments when we feel torn apart inside by the ingratitude and the spite of those that we've loved so very deeply? And for the Lord tells us that he knows what it's like to feel rejected too. No, it's a very tender moment, this. But of course, the key thing to notice is that God does not treat Samuel's disenchantment with the monarchy as just an understandable emotional reaction with which he can sympathize. He does do that, but in addition, he endorses Samuel's theological doubts about it. They haven't just rejected you, he says, it's my kingship they want to dispense with. In other words, your instinct is right, Samuel. There is something illegitimate and dangerous about this people's desire for a king. You're not mistaken at all. This displeasure you feel, though no doubt it's coloured and intensified by your own personal sense of having been defeated at the polls, it's a justified displeasure. And so, you see, we return to the dilemma with which we started. If this picture of Samuel is an accurate picture, and the attitude he adopts towards the monarchy is one which is endorsed by God, why is the Bible generally, and the book of Samuel in particular, not far more anti-monarchist? Well, I want to suggest to you that there is a perfectly credible explanation of that apparent ambiguity, an explanation which involves neither carving the text up into contradictory sources, nor imputing error to spirit-inspired prophets. The clue lies in a very careful comparison between this chapter, 1 Samuel 8, and that passage in the book of Deuteronomy, which I mentioned earlier, Deuteronomy 17. For it is not, I want to suggest to you, the idea of a king as such that Samuel's unhappy about. What is worrying him is the kind of king that the people had in mind. Just look back, if you've got your finger in your Bible, at Deuteronomy 17, and take note of some of the provisions which Moses laid down there in the national constitution to control the institution of monarchy when the time came for it to be established. First of all, we read in verse 16, the king must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself. Almost certainly a reference to the formation of a professional cavalry. There was to be no standing army. Standing armies can be used against the people as well as in their defence. The king, like the judges, would have to rely on the tribal muster, on conscription, to deal with serious military threats. He must not have a huge standing military machine. In addition, we're told, he must not make the people return to Egypt to get more horses. In other words, he mustn't engage in alliances with pagan powers for the purposes of military defence. Israel was to be militantly independent of other powers, and the king, no matter how beneficial he thought an alliance might be, was not to be allowed to trade the people's freedom for imperial protection, whether of Egypt or Assyria or anybody else. Thirdly, we're told, he mustn't take many wives, a prohibition of the harem, which, of course, in the Middle East was a political tool, a tool of international diplomacy. You sealed a peace treaty with your neighbours by adding another princess to your royal household. Such a policy, says Moses, would invite paganization. The king's heart would be led astray, no matter how politically advantageous it might be to take a heathen princess to wife. There is a price that is too great to pay for peace, says Moses. Fourthly, we're told, he must not accumulate large amounts of silver or gold. No provision is made in the law for the king to raise taxes. The tithe belongs to God and is distributed by the Levites. Anyway, without a harem and a professional army, his personal expenditure would be fairly slight, wouldn't it? Moses didn't believe in great public expenditure, you see. The king is there to serve the people, he says, not to feather his own nest by economic exploitation of the peasantry. And fifthly, and perhaps most important of all, we're told in Deuteronomy 17, this king, which Moses permits, is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of the law. And it is to be with him when he sits on his throne, and he's to sit there and read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord and follow carefully all the words of his law, leaving not from to the right hand or the left hand, not departing from it in any way. So here, you see, is a king who can't make laws. A king whose job it is rather to enforce and keep laws already given to him. It's an extraordinary picture, especially when you see it against the context of monarchy in the Middle East 1,000 years BC. Canaanite kings were all tyrants, absolute dictators whose word was law, in complete totalitarian control of their realms. But the King Moses is describing here is hedged around with all kinds of limitations to his powers. He can't have a standing army, he can't have a treasury, he can't have a harem, he can't even pass new legislation. In a word, you see, what we have got here, for the first time in world history, is the concept of constitutional monarchy. A government held in check, not by the pressure of democratic votes by the people. Moses never even considers that possibility. No, a government held in check by the overarching sense of accountability to God. Here is not a government of men at all, but a government of laws, divine laws, which men are simply appointed as trustees of, not as architects of. Now just compare then that picture of constitutional monarchy which Moses laid down with the picture Samuel goes on to draw as the consequence of the people's demand for a king in verses 10 to 18. The consequences of the people's lust for a monarch. Do you see how he describes it? He talks first of all about the military consequences. This is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses. Here's that professional cavalry that Moses said was not to be allowed. He goes on to talk about assigning some to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, a standing army with all its necessary military elite, the barons, the feudal lords. He goes on to talk about the economic consequences in verse 12. He's going to appoint some to plough his ground and reap his harvest. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage. Here is exploitation, taxation, confiscation. Here is the king handing out jobs for the boys and rewarding them out of the national wealth. And finally, says Samuel, look at the political consequences. He will take a tenth of your flocks and you yourselves will become his slaves. This king you want, he says, is going to result in a loss of political self-determination for you. In a word, it's going to mean tyranny. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. Language here that echoes the bondage of the people. That bondage in Egypt, that bondage they had experienced many times through the national emergencies that had arisen during the occupation of Canaan. You will cry to the Lord for release from your oppression, just as you've done in the past, says Samuel. But this time there'll be no Moses, there'll be no Gideon, there'll be no Samson, there'll be no Samuel to deliver you next time. For the Lord will not heed these prayers, born as they will be out of a self-inflicted misery. Now I ask you, is this the pattern of monarchy Moses had described? Well, of course it isn't. Samuel, you see, was sufficiently in touch with the mood of the people to know exactly what kind of king they had in mind when they said, we want a king like the other nations. That's literally what they meant. They meant a monarchy on the Canaanite totalitarian model. And that's why God tells Samuel in verse 9, warn them solemnly. Let them know the kind of justice that this king is going to operate. In other words, let's bring out into the open exactly what kind of regime this people have in mind. And when Samuel describes for them the very opposite of the legal and constitutional monarchy of Deuteronomy 17, when he describes a tyrant, a military dictator of the worst kind, what response does he get? Do they say, oh, you misunderstand us, Samuel? We don't want a king like that. We want a king who upholds the law. We want a king who reads his Bible. We want a king who subjects his judgments to the voice of God's prophets. Is that the answer they give him? No, not at all. They refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said. We want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles. You see, it is, as we said before, an overweening nationalistic pride that motivates them here, not faith. A desire for military glory, not for moral justice. Samuel was right to be concerned. It wasn't a king under God this people were seeking to establish, but a king instead of God. And the long-term consequences of that spiritual rebellion, of course, were precisely as Samuel said it would be. The history of Israel's monarchy, for all the early romance of David's reign, is a history of kings who became dictators. A monarchy that became a tyranny. Just as Samuel said. So what is the lesson of this chapter for us today? Well, I want to suggest to you it's a very important one. I think it was Churchill who said that democracy is the best form of government, or is the worst form of government, except for all the others. And we can all sympathise with that. There's no ideal political system. All political systems have their weaknesses. And democracy, it's true, has a lot to commend it. But I want to suggest to you this morning that democracy is nowhere near as safe. But sometimes we pretend to ourselves it is. The history of our world is littered with examples of peoples and nations who have abdicated their civil liberties and have elected dictators, just as Israel was in danger of doing. One of the most recent contemporary examples is that of Hitler. The ballot box is no infallible defense against tyranny. The will of the people has in our day been used to legitimize countless oppressive regimes, both fascist and communist. Albert Camus points out in his book The Rebel, all modern revolutions have resulted in a reinforcement of the power of the state. And that's something you can see happening everywhere. I want to suggest to you that there is something far more important than democratic procedures for the preservation of human freedom and justice. And that is respect for the law of God. That's why wise nations have constitutions and bills of rights. What do these things represent? They are documents that witness to a higher law than the power of human legislation. Constitutional law witnesses to the moral law, which no king, no president, no democratic vote can contradict. A law which limits the power of government, therefore. And it's only because men in the past have been convinced about the existence of constitutional law, a law which adheres in the eternal nature of things, that democracy in the past has been safe. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the votes of the people. It has to do with the preservation of the Constitution. And I have to tell you that one of the things that makes me so anxious these days in which we live, is the anxiety that that conviction, that constitutional law is eternal law, that it's higher law, that it's law not made by man, that conviction is being undermined because people no longer believe in absolute values. They no longer believe in the higher law. There's an attitude abroad, a humanistic attitude, that sees right and wrong as something to be determined by public opinion. The will of the people is replacing the will of God as the fundamental basis for our social order. Well, I want to warn you, as Samuel warned Israel, that no matter how enlightened and democratic that sounds, it is nothing short of an invitation to tyranny. That is how tyrannies are born. Not because people forget to vote, but because people no longer believe that nations and governments are accountable. to the sovereign creator of the universe. Look at verses 21 and 22 of this chapter. When Samuel heard all the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, listen to them. Give them a king. Don't you find that extraordinary? He is a God who knows the people's idea of monarchy is astray, who knows that in the long term their political aspirations will be disastrous, who recognizes that the kind of king they want to appoint amounts to a rejection of his divine authority over their nation, and yet who nevertheless says to the prophet, listen to them, give them a king. For here, you see, is a God who is not a tyrant. That's the point. Here is a God who accomplishes his will not by preventing human mistakes, but by allowing them, not by denying human freedom, but by granting it. Here is a God who is a model of all true sovereignty, who gives to his subjects freedom. God had given Israel the finest framework of constitutional law any nation had ever had in the history of the world. But if she chose to ignore it and replace his commands and his rule with an absolutist human government, he would not stand in their way. He would let her learn her political lessons by painful experience. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. And the Lord will not answer you in that day. So too for us. The roots of our Western democracies lie deep in the great reformation of biblical religion, which God graciously granted in the 17th century. Christian men like Samuel Rutherford, in his great book Rex Lex, The Law and the King. That was what shaped the pattern of constitutional government that has preserved our civil liberties long before anybody thought of having votes and elections. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. It's the Creator's law that Jefferson and the others stood for, you see. Without the Creator's law, there are no human rights. Without the Creator's law, there can be no constitutional limits to the power of the state. All this was the fruit of that great Puritan inheritance that in the Protestant West we share, and the fear of God that went with it. And if we today forsake that fear and that law, then our democratic traditions will not save us from tyranny any more than the book of Deuteronomy saved Israel from tyranny. God is not obliged to countermand our folly. He gives us freedom. He rules this universe just as much in spite of our stupidity as by means of our obedience. If we forsake his law, he warns us, as he warns Israel, we will pay the penalty in terms of slavery. John Philpot Curran was a great champion of Irish freedom in the 18th century. He once said this in a speech: the condition upon which God hath given liberty to man is eternal vigilance. Which condition, if he break, servitude is at once the consequence of his crime and the punishment of his guilt. That was Samuel's warning to Israel, and I believe it is God's warning to us this morning. Let's pray together.